Hey there, I'm Dominic Armato, and this is Skillet Dude's Top Chef Power Rankings, Season 4, Episode 9. Ugh. Weeks like this may be good TV, they may be entertaining, and they may tell us a lot about how the chefs work with others, but for the power rankings, they're murder. Here's the thing. The chefs didn't succeed or fail this week by cooking good or bad food. Yes, they cooked food, both good and bad, but that was secondary. This week, they succeeded or failed by being smart or being stupid. When you're preparing a huge catered event, working on a team, trying to please clients on one of the biggest days of their lives, and working straight through the night to do it, being talented is a lot less important than making good decisions. This didn't really apply, of course, to the quickfire. The mise en place relay was one of the greatest challenges ever when they introduced it last year, and I hope it becomes a regular fixture. It's exciting, it's a pure test of skill, and it's always interesting to see who comes out knives blazing and who gets exposed. As for the elimination challenge, they should have stuck to the classics for the entire episode. Nobody wants the show to become stagnant, of course, but how do you axe restaurant wars? Or if you do, why replace it with wedding wars? I realize that Season 1's wedding challenge set some precedent for this, but on the week with 8 contestants remaining, the best team challenge potential of the season, the producers took the chefs and turned them into caterers. Now, I'm not joining the chorus of disgruntled Top Chef fans who have taken to calling it Top Caterer by any means. I don't mind having some catering-style challenges mixed in. As I've said, I love the variety, and the show needs to stay fresh. But why this? Why now? And why at the expense of one of the most exciting classic Top Chef challenges for a group of contestants that, almost without exception, aspire to open their own restaurants? Let's keep this in perspective. It's no travesty, but it is unfortunate, and I hope it's something they correct next season. I freshen it up somehow if you have to, but bring back restaurant wars. We all love it for a reason. Trying to deconstruct how well the chefs cooked this week was frustrating even for me. There were some dishes that were obviously the work of certain chefs, but most of them appeared to be collaborative efforts. Some were conceived by certain chefs and executed by others. Only about a third of the food is covered by recipes on the website, and generally speaking, it's almost impossible in many cases to know who precisely is responsible for what. Also, it's a catering challenge, and quite possibly the last team challenge of the season. They might do one with 6 chefs remaining, but I can't see them doing it with 4 or 2. So, considering all this, I'm reluctant to weigh Episode 9 too heavily when it comes to juggling the rankings, but there's some movement nonetheless. In what should come as precisely zero surprise, Richard stays in the top spot. He clearly fell into the smart category this week, and he just keeps on rolling. Okay, I thought picking the bride was pretty stupid, but hey, it worked out pretty well for him, so I suppose that makes him smarter than me. As I read around, there's a large crowd knocking his decision to do a braised brisket. It was too simple and too easy, they say. And they're right, it was simple and easy. He basically slathered the briskets with Cajun spices, seared them, and then slow roasted them with brown sugar and mustard. But, who here thinks Richard hasn't yet proven he can do creative, technically challenging dishes? Anyone? Show of hands? Yeah, exactly. He played it smart. He picked the right week to dial it back a bit and make a simple, satisfying dish that would be easy to scale, easy to transport, and easy to hold. Also, while the website credits Antonia with the pulled pork sandwiches, the pickles on top were done with rice vinegar, tarragon, turmeric, mustard seed, and chili flakes. I could be wrong, but that has Richard written all over it, and it was his idea to do it with Philo, so I'm thinking he was heavily involved there. Also, though I can't find hard evidence of it anywhere, Richard mentions, quote, taking care of all the meats, all the sauces, all the braises, so I think that horseradish sauce that Padma and Tom were curiously gaga over was his as well. So, he made some good food, and even if he wasn't an official team leader, per se, it's clear he was doing a lot of the driving. Note also that the one guy on the team who was getting irritated with his suggestions rather than actually listening to what he had to say ended up being the weak link at Judge's table. All in all, another great week for Richard, right down to deferring to his teammate yet again when it came time to claim credit. This was not a banner week for Dale, but I don't think it reflects on his chances the way some seem to feel it does, and he hangs on to the second spot. Much has been made of his trouble with team challenges, but while some want to label him as somebody who doesn't play well with others, I'd amend that to read that he doesn't play well with those whose skill he doesn't respect. I don't know if that's any better, but it's a notable distinction, I think. The fact is that he's one of the most talented chefs in the competition, and he got saddled with arguably the 3 weakest remaining contestants. He responded poorly, but predictably for anybody who's been watching. What I find sympathetic about him in these situations is that he's frustrated by the same things we are. We agree, Lisa's negativity is more than a little grating. We can't believe Nikki's balking at the prospect of making mayonnaise without a blender. We're annoyed that Spike asks him to take over the zucchini when it's obvious he's already shouldering the load. But we don't have to work with them. He does, at least temporarily, and the guy needs to learn how to get along with and relate to those he doesn't feel are at his level, even if he's usually right about that. Fortunately for him, he might not have to do it the rest of the way out, so I could ding him for the attitude, but that seems kind of senseless considering that it's unlikely to be an issue going forward. As for his food, yeah, it was weak. He did the work of three people, and it wasn't just the editing and his indignant claims that made it seem so. In one of the bonus videos on the website, Antonia agreed that he was working like a madman. Of course, she goes on to say that what he was making was terrible, but how can anybody execute under those circumstances? He should have spoken up, but I'm guessing he knew he wasn't going to be able to do so in a constructive manner, so he chose instead to keep his head down and work, work, work. It was a bad decision, a symptom of his poor attitude, and it resulted in mediocre food, but I don't think he was ever in any real danger. The upshot to being saddled with everything is that even if you do a lousy job of it, everybody else looks just as bad, if not worse, for putting you in that position. I've been rough on Antonia at times, and I still don't think she has any hope of winning, but good work is good work, and she's regaining some of that early season consistency that had her nipping at the heels of the favorites, and I'm kicking her back up to number three this week. She was lauded for her pizzas, which sounds about right. They aren't complicated, but when you're cooking pizzas, small changes in technique pay big dividends. And technique is something that's never been a question with Antonia, even if I can supreme oranges faster than that. Antonia's got a little swagger back. She's marching towards the final, and I think she'll probably make it. You won't find me putting money on her to win, though. Also reclaiming a little lost ground is Stephanie, who moves up to number four. As confidence boosters go, praise from Gail Gand for your overnight wedding cake has to be pretty high on the charts. I'm not sure that Stephanie's cooking this week had any real bearing on the competition, but as we all know, her nemesis is herself, and managing pretty well under trying circumstances has to have her feeling pretty good right now. The website also credits her with the short ribs and blue cheese and phyllo canapé, and that's her style all over, so I'm thinking that attribution is probably correct. There's absolutely no clue as to how the ribs themselves were prepared, but the rest of the recipe looks nice, and it sounds like it was well received, even if it was a little messy. If it's a three-person final, she's gonna be on the bubble. If she's on, I think she makes it, but she can't screw around anymore. So we'll see if this week helps her get herself back in the game. Andrew's time in the top three was rather short-lived, as he once again calls into question his ability to produce consistently and drops down to number five. I do think he had a better week than it might seem at first glance, but his hold on that third spot was more than a little tenuous, so I'm busting him down anyway. He tore through the artichokes, which are a real pain to turn if you've never done it, but really, is anybody surprised that this guy is a high-speed prep machine? As for the elimination, I'm going to stand up for him here, if only a little. Yes, he was one of the stupid people this week. Breaded plus fried plus chafing dish equals blech. But Tom's criticism that he made the same thing last week? That's not exactly fair. They were both chicken paillards, yes, and Andrew should have known better, especially after doing faux caviar three freaking times. But to call last week and this week the same is to make a surface comparison. This week's chicken looks like a really nice recipe. The chicken is brined with star anise, mustard seed, fennel, coriander, cardamom, bay leaf, juniper, and honey. The crust has a nice assortment of spices and fresh herbs, and the yuzu butter sauce sounds awesome. I'm betting that Andrew had the start to a great dish last week, but he was constrained by the challenge, so in his zeal to take it from great to awesome, he charged ahead without stopping to consider that this probably wasn't the best venue for it. He clearly blew it, but I bet this is a great dish under other circumstances, and I understand and admire that compulsion to tweak and adjust and make it even better. Of course, he also made a lousy cream spinach, and Antonia and Stephanie did well, so down he goes. I think he has a shot at a four-person finals, but I just don't see him making the top three without a huge stroke of luck. Holding steady at number six is Spike, by which I mean he's steadily unsteady. I even thought about dropping him below Lisa this week, but I just can't bump her up for making that chocolate hazelnut cake. If I knew for a fact that Spike was responsible for conceptualizing the boring vegetable spread rather than simply executing it, I'd do it. But his highest profile contribution was a dish that was universally praised, which keeps him out of the basement. It's worth noting, however, that while I'm sure his Chilean sea bass with artichokes was nice, the truth is that between this week and last week, his sea bass and pasta puttanesca were actually more similar than Andrew's chicken paillards. I think Spike's a talented chef who's skilled at many things and master of none. This ability to do a lot of things competently has carried him far, but his time is running out. In this field, anything short of excellence isn't gonna cut it. I give him 3 weeks max, probably less. Also holding her spot at number seven is Lisa, who I want to put higher, but I just can't do it. Lisa's been a lot of unfulfilled promise. The chocolate ziggurat is the first good thing she's done since winning 4 weeks ago. And no matter how much promise she flashed, and no matter how much the Bravo bloggers talk about her as though she's one of the most talented chefs remaining, there comes a point where you have to work to your potential or go home. Maybe I should be taking that tone from the bloggers as a hint that she's going to make a late move. I mean, there is dark horse potential here, but until it's realized, she's sitting in the basement. Oh, and for those keeping score, it's now 7 weeks since she's done what is supposedly her specialty, upscale Asian. If anybody knows what to make of this, please feel free to fill me in. And lastly, if I may make an announcement, this past Wednesday, at approximately 11:10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Michael Midgley did his best 72 Dolphins impersonation by cracking a bottle of champagne and celebrating Nikki's demise. Or at least he should have. By finally blowing it this week, Nikki's streak of unwarranted survival came to a screeching halt at 8 weeks, one shy of the 9 episodes that Mikey managed to defy all logic, to say nothing of culinary convention and the very laws of time and space. Nikki had to basically do everything wrong to make it happen, but ladies and gentlemen, our national nightmare is now over. I'm sure Top Chef Nation let out a collective groan when J.P. Marchetti revealed his family's love of simple Italian cuisine, but a few minutes later, when Nikki realized she'd inadvertently stuck her neck out and started backtracking like a sleep-deprived politician, you knew it was over. First, when her teammates peg her for mayonnaise duty, she acts like they're asking her to shuck oysters with her teeth. And then, not only does the Italian specialist design a menu that would put the Carrabba's crowd to sleep, but she turns tail, becomes one with her inner coward, and then manages to botch the one dish she actually has direct control over. Don't get me wrong, she seems like a perfectly lovely person. It's just that, as usual, Dale said what all of us were thinking.
Why are you still here?
Relax, everybody. It's been a long, inexplicable run, but we no longer need wonder why Nikki is still here. With Nikki gone, everything's up for grabs. As I see it, next week is the very first episode where a contender's elimination is guaranteed, provided, of course, the judges don't throw one of those "we're not eliminating anybody this week" curveballs. At this point, honestly, nobody's safe. If the elimination challenge were taking place in a real kitchen, I'd feel comfortable assuming at least that Richard, Dale, and Antonia would all live to see another week. But serving off-site for Chicago's finest-to-be? It's dangerous, no matter how good you are. After the more than a little misleading teasers of the past few weeks, I'm through trying to speculate what happens based on the tiny scraps the editors throw our way. But I think I can safely say that nothing from here on out will surprise me. So, is it Wednesday yet?